Good evening. We have two new faces tonight. Welcome to you. Dennis has written to me, so we've met a little bit. And how did you hear about us?
It's been a few years since I was here last.
You were here before. Glad you're here. Let's do introductions all the way around.
Francois.
Wendy.
Dan.
Julian.
Dennis.
Samia. Britt.
Chris.
Kisayel.
Ron.
Angie. I remember. It came from way far back somewhere. We're in the middle of talking about the Heart Sutra, which we just chanted. It's such a mysterious piece of work. We chant it every time we meet. It's chanted at just about everything that happens in Zen, whether we're doing a full moon ceremony or a funeral or a wedding or an ordination, it always comes up. It's the full expression of our practice, strange as it may seem. The part that we've gotten to is the basic first teaching of Shakyamuni Buddha. No suffering, no origination of suffering, no stopping of suffering, and no path. That's what we chant. Buddha's teaching was suffering. He tried to figure out what was going on with us, what our life, what this was. And he figured out that it was really hard, and that there must be a reason for why it was so hard for everybody. And that's why he sat down under the tree. That's why he determined to do something. He'd studied every philosophy, every practice that there was, went to all the best teachers in his time. But he said as soon as he stood up, the suffering came back again. So how to understand it? We always have the same question ourselves. Of course. And what he understood was how our mind works around our life. That we want what we don't have, and we don't want what we do have, and we get totally stuck in that mode. And it's based on our understanding of who we are or what we are. We think we're this fixed, very important being. Of course, trying to survive. A very important little animal trying to survive just from the very beginning. And then on top of the animal nature of us trying to get enough to eat and to be sheltered from the weather, we also have this history and conditioning that gives us a story and gives us someone to be. And as part of having a story, we start to accumulate things we like and things we don't like. We start accumulating judgments, both about ourselves and about the world, and start trying to manipulate the world and make it come out right for us. And Buddha recognized that we didn't have to do that. He saw that our mind is a constant fountain of impulses and thoughts, ideas. As Aitken Roshi said, it's squirting ideas all the time, squirting thoughts. As you notice when you sit down, it's the first thing, it just begins to tell its own story. And we identify with it. Oh, that's me. But actually, the longer we sit, the more we realize that our thoughts are not ourself. That our self is something bigger than just our thoughts. And that we have good thoughts and we have bad thoughts. We have some really beautiful, beautiful, totally, deeply compassionate and wise thoughts. And we have some really ugly ones. And a basic part of sitting is to begin to recognize all of it. Acknowledge all of it. Not try to sieve it out and make it look good or make it fit some kind of idea we have about who we are, but to really look at who we are, what's going on. And Buddha said, with the second noble truth, we can encourage what's good in us and discourage what's not good. Encourage the wholesome and discourage the non-wholesome. It's not even a fancy practice. It isn't elaborate. It's difficult. But it's pretty simple. So they say he was like a doctor. The doctor has to study the patient and see, oh, what's going on here, and then diagnose it. Oh, it's clinging, it's grasping, it's thirst. Sometimes they use the word thirst. That's the problem. We're thirsty. But, oh, we can do something about that. We don't have to thirst for every chocolate eclair in the bakery window. We have some choice and control over our desires. We can't make them go away, but we can certainly understand them. And understand how our life is contingent on every other life, so that we cannot separate ourselves. But in the fourth noble truth, we practice with everyone. We practice with right thoughts and right speech and right... I always forget that list. But it's a simple thing. It's just life. But life that's awake and self-aware. And broadened and deepened as we learn more and more about ourselves and become more and more honest. So it becomes more and more interesting also, because we understand more about other people also. The more we know about ourselves, the more we can understand others. And that leads to wonders. Right view, right intention, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, and right meditation. So it's just our ordinary, simple life. We try to do the very best we can. Someone wrote to me the other day and said she was suddenly realized that she was using her speech in a kind of funny way, that she was using it in order to get people to like her, and she was talking when she really didn't need to say something, but just to kind of keep a connection that wasn't quite real or honest. She said, oh, it was such revelation just to think about speech and realize what a role it had in her life, how helpful it was to take that in. So this is Buddha's most basic teaching. And as we said last week, his second teaching is helpful when things are a little bit more complicated, and that is the 12 links of dependent origination, which is a big mouthful, which means that that our craving comes from our ignorance. So ignorance starts the whole thing rolling. And ignorance creates craving because we don't realize who we are. We don't realize that we're fine, that we don't need anything more, that it's all given to us from the beginning. So we begin to want more. Well, I have one eclair, but I sure would love to have two or three more. And then there's some other things in there that would be really good too, and let's see, what can I get? And you start adding and accreting all this amazing kind of life and world on the assumption that it's not okay, that there's something missing. It's a kind of secret feeling that there's no ground under our feet, which is actually what the Heart Sutra is saying. So it becomes causal connections, as they say. So it goes from ignorance to a conditioning of consciousness, and then waking up to naming things and the forms of things. And that goes to eye, ear, nose, tongue, body, mind. Here we are. We're taking all this stuff in. And then that leads to contact. And contact, we begin to feel touched in some way, and then we begin to feel something about our contact, and that leads to craving. And the craving leads to clinging, and the clinging leads to birth, the birth of somebody. And the birth then conditions aging, death, sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief, and despair, which leads to ignorance. It's not a pretty picture. In fact, did I bring that? This is how it's shown in the ancient way. The monster is time, holding the wheel, which is ignorance and craving and all of those things. And in the middle are greed, anger, and ignorance, which drives the wheel. And the greed, anger, and ignorance are greed, anger, and delusion, sometimes they say, are based on our unwillingness to really see what's going on. So that's the beginning. But you notice that the Heart Sutra is saying no. The Heart Sutra, I always think, is like a big eraser for a blackboard, like our teachers used to have when we just go, no eye, no ear, no nose, no tongue, no body, no mind, no suffering, no origination, no stopping, no path, no cognition, also no attainment. It's seeing through even these ideas, even these teachings, and seeing that we can cling even to the teachings and make something solid out of them, something fixed. And then we become deluded again. We have something to hold on to, but in truth, even the teachings are empty. They came from somewhere, and they are transforming continually, morphing continually, through us, through life, through the dynamics of life, so that we can't even hold on to Buddha's teaching. It doesn't mean we get rid of it, actually. We don't really erase it. We see through. We see it's not permanent. Nothing is permanent. So I have a handout which might or might not be useful, but maybe you could take a look at it. You want to pass it around? Thank you. The amazing thing is that Buddha was a real person, and the place where he was enlightened is still there, and you can go there and sit under the same tree, or at least a cutting from that same tree. It's, as someone said about our Zazen, it's not really a practice or an idea, it's alive. Our sitting is alive. Buddha's sitting was alive. And the awakening of Buddha was our awakening. Here we are. So you must have some questions. Julian?
Could you expand a little bit about ignorance? I'm not sure how this is your ignorance conditions formations. I don't get it.
Well, they're technical terms, and I don't really remember them very well as technical terms. I like to use this scheme or schematic as a schematic in a more general way. You can get very academic about it, and you can read in lots of places about it if you're really interested. But I think the overall view is much more interesting and much more useful to us than exactly what each thing is.
Well, I guess if we're speaking out of the Heart Sutra, that tells us that there's no real solid thing to stand on.
Mm-hmm.
It seems ignorance is a pretty natural.
Yes.
Maybe it just beats against the tactical, but it's just,
yes.
Well, you know, there's really nothing.
Oh, that's what the Heart Sutra says too.
Ignorance, so.
No ignorance and also no extinction of it and so forth until no old age and death and also no extinction of them. That's the 12 links. So it's already wiped those out before it gets to the Four Noble Truths. Dan?
One of the biggest mistakes I make, and I can see myself doing it even though I know I'm doing it, is I project at the highest level, once you climb all the way up to the consciousness level, I'll project something that's risen all the way through the others out onto the world. So I think that after I've processed something through all these, through this chain, then, like at the worst possible point, namely at the top of the chain, I'll project that out onto other people and say, I want you to believe the way I do after all this work I've done. And that's when I get into real trouble. I can see people fighting that. And yet, I'm not projecting it because I think it's wrong. I'm projecting because I think it's right.
But believe is the word there. If we end up having to believe anything, we're already in trouble. And trying to make somebody else believe something is even more so. This is about finding out what's true. And if we don't know what's true, we really do have to say we don't know. And we can tell our truth. I mean, we need to tell our truth. We need each other's truth in order to... We need each other in that way. But we can't insist on belief for ourselves either. You know, it's much more scientific to keep an open mind. And I think it's much more of a scientific practice than we often think. That it really is about being carefully sensitive to what's real for us, rather than so many ideas about it. Samuel?
So going back to the eclairs, what if you make them and pass them out?
It's great.
You know they're not extremely healthy, but you enjoy making them and people enjoy them and it's in moderation.
Sure. It's wonderful.
I'm talking beyond the eclairs.
Yes. Yeah. So, anytime you want to...
I'm mean, fruit would be better, right? But sometimes an eclair is really good.
Of course.
It hits the spot.
Of course. It's more like, I've been thinking about it. I told this story here, and I just told it a day or so ago again, about Lori Levinson, and how when she had her horrible accident in her 20s in an automobile accident and was paralyzed from her waist down and ended up in a wheelchair with legs that didn't work, and when she was well enough, started going about town, getting her groceries and all of those in her wheelchair. And people stopped her and said, several people actually said this to her, if that had happened to me, I would kill myself. And she said, after a while she realized, as people were looking at her like, ew, that she was going to either have to kill herself or do something. And she just pulled herself together and got a job and adopted a child, fixed up her house herself. She laid tiles and bricks down to make a patio. She was amazing, just amazing, and lived for 35 years in a wheelchair with complete... She went camping by herself, driving out into the desert, camping by rivers. She was completely autonomous because she didn't let those thoughts drive her life. Her own thoughts and other people's. She just picked herself up inside and made a life. I think it's a wonderful example. It's extreme. I don't know how many of us would be able to do that. I'm not sure I would. But it's what Buddha was talking about. That's the kind of honesty and clarity and facing reality that he's talking about.
Eclair, I mean, is the eclair really that good, or is it our idea of the eclair? I mean, so you could.
It's not really about something like that. It's more about clinging to what we want. It's saying, I have to have that eclair. There's no other way about it. I have to have it no matter what. Or I have to not have the eclair and have all kinds of ideas about that. The life itself just comes and goes. Sometimes eclairs come into our lives and we appreciate them, and then if we're wise, we let them go. But we don't get up in the morning and say, I want more. You know, it's sort of...
It'll go anyway.
Yes, it all goes. And if we let it go, then new things come. And if we don't let it go, we're not available to whatever new thing is coming. So it's important for our life. Otherwise, it gets very ingrown and knotted up because we can't open up to what our life really is. What's happening.
I'm not getting the problems with the eclairs.
There is no problem with the eclairs. The wanting them when you can't have them is the problem.
Yes.
That's the trick. I know. Well, it's 8 o'clock.